listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Jake Neer, sitting in for Stephen Henderson today. The Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act that many have yearned for has now passed. It's now law here in the United States. But that's after a century of stalls and blockades, and well beyond the point at which lynchings are as common as they were in the early 1900s in this country. And that leaves us with deep questions. Why did a law protecting citizens against such heinous acts take so long to pass? What does the law actually do now for people in 2022? And does its passage signify any sort of progress towards social equality in America? And I want to welcome another voice to this conversation. I'm very excited to talk with Leslie Scott, who is an associate professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy, who studies these issues. Leslie Scott, it's great to have you here on Detroit Today.
Thank you so much, Jake. It is so great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. So before we talk about the actual text of this bill, I want to take a listen to what President Joe Biden said about racism in America after he signed the anti-lynching bill into law.
Racial hate isn't an old problem. It's a persistent problem. A persistent problem. And I know many of the civil rights leaders here know, you've heard me say it 100 times, hate never goes away. It only hides. It hides under the rocks. Given just a little bit of oxygen, it comes roaring back out, screaming. But what stops it is all of us, not a few. All of us have to stop it.
Professor Scott, really powerful words there from the president, especially right. In the context of this. You know, what does this signify to you? What was your reaction when, after, again, more than a century, President Biden right. was able to sign this into law?
Right. I mean, very powerful words. And you know, President Biden is right. Hate, it exists, and it may not exist as blatantly as, some of the forms that we think of when we think about lynching in the late 1800s and early to mid 1900s, the last speaker was talking about. But, we can still feel those after effects of lynching. And we have some examples, right, that we could talk about mm-hmm. of modern day lynching. So thinking, of course, about Ahmaud Arbery in February right. of 2020 and sort of that coming on the heels of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and before that, you had James Byrd Jr., who was murdered by 3 white supremacists in 1998. And so I would agree with those who say that this law is long overdue, right? And it took a long, too long, right, for this bill to be signed into law. But I have feelings of hope and optimism because, better late than never, I guess, as the right. saying goes. But I think that what's really important about this, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more later in the segment, is that, there are limits to what one criminal law can do, right? Mm-hmm. So criminal laws come in and they're sort of a way to try to bring some sort of closure or healing or peace to a crime or a social ill that's already been committed. And so by virtue of that, they're sort of coming in after the fact. No anti-lynching law can bring Ahmaud Arbery back, though, or those whose lives were lost before him. And so, we hope for some sort of deterrent effect with a law like this, but expectations of deterrence tend to rely, I think, on a flawed understanding of criminal behavior. And so what are we left with? I think we're left with the hope that this historical moment will lead to more conversations like the one that we're having today, and perhaps even deeper conversations about the need for more than just a new criminal law to bring us closer to equality, the need for conversations about providing social services mm-hmm. to victims of hate crimes and expanding compensation for victims of hate crimes, requiring defendants to participate in educational programs and community service. I mean, the other thing that I think is worth noting is that the vast majority of hate crimes in this country are not going to be covered by this anti-lynching law, the vast majority of hate crimes, somewhere around 98 to 99%, are property type of crimes, vandalism, simple assault, threats that do not result in death or serious bodily injury. And so for crimes like that, we need to think about, you know, at some point, these offenders are going to be back on the street. So what can we do in terms of education and community service to prevent this from happening in the future? And conversations really about critical race theory in the classroom and teaching the truth to our young people about the history of lynchings and other types of hate crimes in America. You know, as you know, that's another big, you were talking about the filibuster,
right?
Which is a big hot button issue. This is another one, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about not teaching the truth about African-American history to young people. And I think that's problematic. And so this bill and this signing is really meaningful because it's, I hope at least, that it is prompting these kinds of conversations on the radio, but also in the classroom.
Yeah, yeah. That is such an interesting point. And you know, Professor Eric Foner of Columbia, before we ended that conversation at the beginning of the show, was saying that, you know, he was talking about how lynchings, in the definition that we often think of them, where people are invited, that it's an event that, you know, this is, you know, there are hundreds of people in the street watching this happen, don't happen the way that they now, the way that they do then. And he was saying that it's not, you know, that lynching in that sense doesn't exist. I'm curious what this law does in terms of, you know, distinguishing what might count as lynching versus other hate crimes, or maybe even non-hate crimes. You know, what are your thoughts about the way that we define this and the way that this law defines what lynching is?
Sure. Yeah. So interestingly, the law itself does not specifically define lynching other than to say that a lynching is a conspiracy to commit a hate crime. But I think we all have sort of a general understanding of what a lynching is. You know, as Professor Foner was explaining, you know, historically lynchings were these huge sort of mobs of people who, white people generally, who committed these extrajudicial and violent public acts of physical and psychological torture and killing of a person based on race. And oftentimes, you know, lynchings were done sort of with impunity or even implicitly or explicitly encouraged by law enforcement. You don't see that form today, of course, but you do see other forms. And I will say, you know, if we think about the purpose behind the lynching, the purpose was to exercise social control and reinforce the racial hierarchies that existed in the 1800s and mid-1900s, early 1900s, and to reinforce segregation. And so there are sort of less overt ways of doing that today, including, you know, I don't need to go into the details, but everyone knows about Ahmaud Arbery. That's sort of the most obvious example. So if we look at the text of this particular act and what it says, as I mentioned, it doesn't specifically define lynching other than to say it's a conspiracy to commit a hate crime. And so hate crimes are defined in the original act, which is called the Shepard-Byrd Hate Crimes Act. That was federal legislation that was signed into law by President Obama in 2009, and it's named after two hate crime victims. James Byrd was a black man who was killed by three white supremacists, so that would have been defined as a lynching. And Matthew Shepard was killed for being gay. And so you have to look to the original act for the definition of a hate crime itself. And it defines a hate crime as willfully causing bodily injury or death or attempting to do so with a dangerous weapon because of the victim's actual or perceived race, color, religion, national origin, and then extending, of course, to actual or perceived sexual orientation, gender, or gender identity. And so what the new lynching provision does is it criminalizes a conspiracy to do any of those things that I just mentioned, you know, willfully causing death or bodily injury or attempting to do so. You've got to, I guess, think about what does that mean? What does it mean to conspire to commit a hate crime, the conspiracy also has to result in serious bodily injury or death under the law. So the law is relatively narrow in three ways. First, the federal government has to show that a person charged committed a hate crime, right, as defined in the original act. And that's not always easy to do, right, mm-hmm. because you have to show willfulness, so intentionality. You also have to show a racial motive, mm-hmm. Which is not always easy to do. Second, the victim must have died or sustained serious bodily injury in order for the new law to apply. Serious bodily injury includes substantial risk of death, unconsciousness, extreme pain, disfigurement, or loss or impairment of a bodily function or mental faculty. And then the last way in which the law is somewhat narrow is that the government, as I mentioned, has to prove a conspiracy to commit the hate crime. So a conspiracy is an agreement between two or more people to commit a crime. And so in this way, the act retains the significance of lynching as a group crime. Right. Mm-hmm. Because, again, as Professor Foner said, we think about these big lynch mobs as sort of the definition of lynching. But a lynching really is just a group of people. And it doesn't have to be a huge group. And it doesn't have to be a public spectacle. Oftentimes it is. But, you know, in the case of Emmett Till, for example, I think we'd all agree that that was a lynching. A 14-year-old boy who was killed by two white men for allegedly whistling at a white woman. So that wasn't a huge public spectacle,
right.
But he was certainly brutally tortured and killed and then thrown into a lake.
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing I'll say about the new law is, you know, on a practical level, the other thing that the new law appears to do is increase the 10-year maximum penalty for the solitary act of committing a hate crime that results in serious injury but not death. To 30 years.
Mm.
So it was 10 years, but it's increased to 30 years as long as the hate crime involves two or more people.
Yeah.
So again, the focus is really on group criminality, which makes sense because that's what a lynching was understood to be and is understood to be.
Sure. All right. Well, coming up, we are going to continue this conversation about this new anti-lynching law that is finally on the books after more than a century here in America and what it means in bringing justice to the system. We'll hear more from Leslie Scott, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Detroit Mercy here on Detroit Today. And we're going to take more of your phone calls and comments on social media. You can call us at 313-577-1019. You can also leave your comments on Twitter using the hashtag Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Jake Neer in for Stephen Henderson. We're talking all hour about the new Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act, which was just signed into law recently by President Joe Biden. What it does, what the practical implications are, how we define lynching in America, and sort of what it means here in 2022. And it's a timely conversation. We're talking about this on the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Coming up in June, we will be coming up on the 40th anniversary of the murder of Vincent Chin here in Detroit, which I think also is another thing to think about as we're having conversations like these. And I'm talking with Leslie Scott, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Detroit Mercy. And we also want to hear from you. Of course, the number on the phones is 313-577-1019. Again, that's 313-577-1019. You can also leave your comments on Twitter using the hashtag Detroit Today. Big Neo on Twitter says, It took 100 years plus to get an anti-lynching law because of the way folks in power could always find a way to sidestep the issue by bills having too many things attached to them. If America starts to have single-issue bills to argue, time delays like this will not end. That's an interesting point there from Big Neo. I want to go to the phones and take a friend of the show here, Alberta in Detroit. Alberta, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so very much for taking my call and for having this timely discussion today. I want to indicate, first of all, that the repercussions from Reconstruction continue to be felt today. What my question is, what happened to the children of those who led those campaigns to slay Black people?
Mm.
We're offspring. We're talking about they created white privilege. Is white privilege real? Yes, and this was the beginning of it.
Mm.
There are a few things I have to mention. Please allow me to.
Absolutely.
Number one, how can we create any sense of normalcy today? It would be difficult, but I think that we need to fund every existing Black historical college to hire persons who can go throughout the country in Black communities and recruit students starting in kindergarten for higher education. This program needs to be put on steroids.
Hmm.
It should also include nonprofits across the nation who service Black people. I will say this. America will never reach its height of greatness until the real, true, tangible actions are taken to make all Blacks whole.
Albert,
and let me not forget reparations. Reparations now.
Yeah.
Alberta,
I so appreciate that perspective. It's always wonderful to hear from you on the show. Thank you so much for that. Professor Leslie Scott of University of Detroit Mercy, I'll give you a chance to react to what Alberta is saying there. And also, I think she gets to a really important point about this. You know, this anti-lynching law, I think, it's so clearly the right thing to do. But what does it mean in this bigger picture of making real racial progress, making sure that we are, as you mentioned near the beginning of our conversation here, there are so many other things that need to happen to make a real true faith effort to really address these things.
Right. That's a great point. And I really appreciate Alberta's comment, and it's well taken, because I think it does sort of bring us full circle to back to the beginning of our conversation, which is that, I'll say a little bit about my own background quickly here. I'm a professor now, but before that I was an assistant federal public defender. And so I represented people charged with crimes in federal court. This is a federal law. And so with that background, I'm someone who generally advocates against the expansion of criminal prohibitions and penalties, certainly in other contexts, like in the drug, the war on drugs context is the big one that I write about and talk about, because I just think that there's only so much that criminal prohibitions and extra penalties can do to cure these social ills that Alberta was mentioning in her comment. And so I think that the practical impact of adding a new criminal penalty for group torture is somewhat limited. But I think the bigger impact is the sort of the symbolism. The fact that it took us 122 years to say as a society, lynching is a hate crime. So now what does that mean? We have the opportunity to reckon with this history and to decide as a nation, where do we want to go from here? And reparations is certainly an important topic, and I agree with Alberta that needs to be something that we continue to talk about and consider. Conversations about, the fact that so many hate crimes go unreported because the victims of hate crimes have a healthy distrust of law enforcement that roots from, the history of lynching and the fact that law enforcement sanctioned lynching and was, law enforcement was often involved in lynching.
Mm-hmm.
George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. I mean, these are examples of the reason why Black people have a distrust of law enforcement. And so many hate crimes go unreported for that reason.
Yeah.
So what can we do to prevent that, from funding, really? Money needs to go into training law enforcement and into social services, reparations, expanding compensation. As I mentioned before, conversations about the role, if any, that restorative justice might play in the hate crimes context. And then, you know, Alberta said it best, young people need to know about this history. And so we need to be talking about race theory and lynchings and other really hard topics in the classroom from a fairly early age, I would say.
Detroit 1701 says on Twitter, at this point in time, it means nothing, referring to this new Emmett Till anti-lynching law. This should have been passed 150 years ago, he says. I want to take a call who's from someone who is saying something similar as well. Jerry in Detroit, welcome to Detroit Today.
Hello to both of you today.
Hi. What would you like to say?
Hi.
I have a comment and also a question, if I may.
Sure.
You know, even though whether it's 100 years or whether it's just in the last month or so, I think it's about time that something like this needed to be implemented, because there has to be accountability for many of these heinous crimes in a lot of these cases. And my question to your guest is, what do you think of the efforts by some, particularly white racists on the right, to try and, you know, basically whitewash and revise history? You know, they're claiming that, you know, the story about the so-called 1,300 white Republicans who were lynched, and to basically try to minimize and downplay what African-Americans during that time.
I hear that, Jerry. Thank you very much for this point. Leslie, I'll let you respond to what Jerry's
sure.
saying there.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously very troubling to me. And I think that, you know, I agree with you, the first caller who said, you know, this is empty, this means nothing at this point. I can understand that sort of initial gut reaction. It does feel empty in some ways when it took this long, you know, and there are still senators who didn't sign off on this.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I tend to agree that better late than never, right? And so, if anything, this is allowing us to have these conversations, it's prompting these conversations. You know, obviously, it's deplorable when politicians and other people try to whitewash history and argue that, you know, certain things didn't happen that we all know did happen. You know, and to argue that victims of lynching were largely, you know, white people. I mean, it's just ludicrous. So I think that, you know, all of those points can be fairly easily sort of researched and proven to be false. But it's important that, you know, educators in particular are not afraid to have these conversations in the classroom, despite sort of the political the political discourse, some of the negative political discourse around it. I do want to, if you don't mind, this is a little bit off topic, but it sort of goes back to your the first point that you made, the other caller who said, you know, this took so long and it's, you know, obvious racism. I agree that, you know, racism has been an obstructing force when it comes to passing this law. More recently, you had some objections in 2018 or 2019 from Senator Rand Paul about the language being too broad and imprecise. But there have been some, I don't know if I want to say criticisms of the new law or critiques, maybe critique is the better word, that I think are worthy of talking about that aren't necessarily rooted in racism. So one criticism that I've read, which actually comes more from the left, I think, than from the right, is that, and this is something, again, as a former public defender, that I can sort of sympathize with, and it's the idea that adding yet another crime to the federal criminal code, and a crime that includes conduct that's already criminalized elsewhere, just contributes to this country's mass incarceration problem without providing much in the way of deterrence. And deterring future crime. And so as someone who writes and speaks out against mass incarceration of Black and brown people, and who has read the studies that pretty convincingly show that it's the certainty of punishment that really serves as the best deterrent rather than its severity, I can sort of understand that critique. And so I guess my response to that particular critique is twofold. First, I would say that mass incarceration is primarily a direct result of the war on drugs, right, which was launched back in the 70s, expanded into the 80s. And so it was not, mass incarceration has not historically been a result of lynchings, punishment for lynchings, or other forms of violent crime. Mm-hmm. And so it's my hope that this new law will be used relatively infrequently, of course, if at all. Maybe it won't have to be used. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of offenders currently incarcerated are there for nonviolent drug offenses. And so the other thing I'll say is that, you know, this country's harsh drug laws and policies had a disproportionate impact on people of color, and the anti-lynching law is meant to protect people of color. Mm-hmm. What'll be interesting is to see whether that happens, right? We know that drug laws have been disproportionately enforced against Black and brown people. And so I suppose the same could happen with this new hate crime law. That's something I want to think about a little bit more.
Right.
There is at least some support for this concern that was recently discussed in a report by Stanford Law School's Law and Policy Lab, along with the Brennan Center for Justice. And so this report suggests that Black people actually might be statistically overrepresented as offenders in mm-hmm. hate crime offender data.
That's interesting.
And so that's interesting, and obviously that's a little bit troubling.
Right.
My other response is that, you know, this law has been fairly narrowly circumscribed in the ways that I discussed earlier. And so, you know, I think that the vast majority of people affected by an anti-lynching law will already be serving, long sentences, right? They'll already be serving life sentences potentially.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, Professor Scott, I don't mean to cut you off. I only have 30 seconds,
okay.
But I wanted to make sure got this last question in, which is,
okay.
You know, we brought up some modern examples. Of course, Ahmaud Arbery, you mentioned George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. Are there mm-hmm. specific, modern day sort of cases that we might know about that you think could have been affected or gone, that this new law could have had something to, could have changed anything about the outcomes? And again, I only have about 30 seconds.
Oh, gosh, that's impossible to answer in 30 seconds. I don't know that it would change the outcome, right? It goes back to this idea of deterrence. And do we really believe that a new law that establishes a 30-year stat max is a deterrent? Mm-hmm. You know, we hope so. But the problem with that reasoning is that oftentimes offenders just simply don't consider the consequences of their action. You know, they're not thinking rationally
sure.
before they break the law. A lot of people are just not aware of the potential penalties associated with their crimes. And lastly, they don't think they're going to get caught, mm-hmm. right? Nobody goes out and commits a crime thinking that they're going to be caught. So, you know, I don't know if this law would have prevented the Ahmaud Arbery's of the world, but it certainly punishes the conduct in a way that fits the crime, right? It is a lynching. Let's call it a lynching. Let's not be afraid to do that. But really, it goes back to the social services and expanding compensation, all the things we talked about earlier. I think those types of things are what we need to focus on in terms of prevention.
Leslie Scott, Associate Professor. I'm so sorry. We're out of time. Leslie Scott.
We could talk so much longer about this, but I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on. This is WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. Thank you so much for listening.